A poem need not assume a literal form or parade itself as a visual pun in order to exercise visual qualities that communicate on a level beyond that of language alone. Although shaped optical poetry existed long before the printing press, graphic poetry is a product of the age of print. Typographical arrangements of letters, lines, and words can send signals, create larger literary structures, divert attention, or even help to announce allusions. A common form of organization in free verse is syntactical parallelism, which often produces long lines referred to by David Rothman as anaphoric versicles. Mimicking repetitions common to ancient Hebraic prosody, it establishes a pattern that may continue over the course of a long poem. This method may be used to build a theme, amplify a sensation, or mint ironic juxtapositions, but most importantly, it creates form in the absence of meter. One may draw a direct line from English mystical poet Christopher Smart to American poet of the self, Walt Whitman, though the good gray poet could not have known of Smart's Jubilate Agno, and beyond to Allen Ginsberg and C.K. Williams. In the middle of the 18th century, while committed to a madhouse, Christopher Smart composed a long devotional poem titled Jubilate Agno, Rejoice in the Lamb, not published until 1939. It has gained considerable popularity, largely due to its affectionate and inventive series of addresses to his cat Jeffrey. For he can spraggle upon waggle at the word of command, for he can jump from an eminence into his master's bosom, for he can catch the cork and toss it again, for he is hated by the hypocrite and miser, for the former is afraid of detection, for the latter refuses the charge, for he camels his back to bear the first notion of business, for he is good to think on, if a man would express himself neatly. Each morally instructive line proceeds from the anchoring preposition for, to describe the admirable traits of the author's familiar. This quality permits the poem to lunge forward, and also lends a pleasing lilt to the otherwise unmatched lines. In a first for American poetry, Walt Whitman used syntactic parallelism to organize his long poem Song of Myself. As his best biographer Justin Kaplan explains, to sing the song of himself, his nation, and his century, he had to cut himself loose from the conventional themes, stock ornamentation, literary allusions, romance, rhyme, anything that existed for the sake of tradition alone and reflected alien times, alien cultures. Whitman's outsized persona could not be contained by the tidy stanzas framed by the more conventional fireside poets. Whitman layers lines in direct address to the reader to establish a vivid familiarity. Have you reckoned 1,000 acres much? Have you reckoned the earth much? Have you practiced so long to learn to read? Have you felt so proud to get at the meaning of poems? Stop this day and night with me, and you shall possess the origin of all poems. You shall possess the good of the earth and sun. There are millions of suns left. You shall no longer take things at second or third hand, nor look through the eyes of the dead, nor feed on the specters in books. You shall not look through my eyes either, nor take things from me. You shall listen to all sides and filter them from yourself. The first three interrogative lines begin, "Have you?" The sequence then pivots on "Stop" in the fourth line and resumes with four imperative lines beginning, "You shall." The appearance of three negatives, "nor," within these lines creates yet another triple repetition. Whitman uses repetition to create a strong rhetorical drive and sense of intimacy. Allen Ginsberg, a poet deeply indebted to this technique, cited both Smart and Whitman as models for his famous 1956 dithyrambic poem, Howl. Who lounged hungry and lonesome through Houston seeking jazz or sex or soup, and followed the brilliant Spaniard to converse about America and eternity, a hopeless task, and so took ship for Africa, who disappeared into the volcanoes of Mexico, leaving behind nothing but the shadow of dungarees and the lava and ash of poetry scattered in fireplace Chicago, who reappeared on the West Coast investigating the FBI in beards and shorts, with big pacifist eyes, sexy in their dark skin, passing out incomprehensible leaflets, who burned cigarette holes in their arms, protesting the narcotic tobacco haze of capitalism. Ginsburg refers to the fixed base WHO in a 1956 letter to Richard Eberhardt. He also remarked that the poem is really built like a brick shithouse. At the time, Ginsburg's poetics centered on his notion of a physiological breath line. He commented that, ideally, each line of Howl is a single breath unit. My breath is long. That's the measure. One physical mental inspiration of thought contained in the elastic of a breath. The extraordinarily long lines trigger a head rush and can be held together only by repeating the descriptive who did that and who did this of the poem's reportage. Along the same lines, C.K. Williams is known for composing in passages that, visually at least, resemble prose paragraphs. Although he relies less on repetition than his predecessors, it is hard to ignore the obvious similarities, as one finds in his terrifying poem Tar, written after the Three Mile Island meltdown, in what he described as those first disquieting, uncertain, mystifying hours. I remember the president, in his absurd protective booties, looking absolutely unafraid, the fool. I remember a woman on the front page glaring across the misty Susquehanna at those looming stacks. But, more vividly, the men silvered with glitter from the shingles, clinging like starlings beneath the eaves. Even the leftover carrots of tar in the gutter, so black, they seemed to suck the light out of the air. By nightfall, kids had come across them. Every sidewalk on the block was scribbled with obscenities and hearts. Each extended line is also a complete syntactical unit, ending in a full stop. The repetition of I remember sets up a parallel that is amplified and turned with the conjunction but more vividly. It is hard to imagine lines growing any longer without simply becoming small prose poems. William Carlos Williams patterned his late long poem Asphodel, That Greeny Flower, into tumbling indented tercets, a shape that makes the unmetered, unrhymed poem more approachable, though Williams claims he wrote in that fashion only because it helped him to see the poem more clearly, despite failing eyesight. Of asphodel, that greeny flower, like a buttercup, upon its branching stem, save that it's green and wooden, I come, my sweet, to sing to you. Indented lines in a free verse stanza represent a vestigial metrical phenomenon. Traditional stanza forms sometimes included dimeter or trimeter lines, known as bobs, to bring variety to the regular tetrameter or pentameter lines that surround them. In a similar vein, the quatrain, perhaps the most recognizable stanza form in English, continues its popularity even in free verse, where it often appears more as a ghost stanza, in which the visual qualities of the quatrain survive, while a standard oral shape, informed by meter and rhyme, has been dropped. Beyond mere parallelism, line length itself may be used to reinforce larger rhetorical aims, as Paul Fussell observes in the gradual opening up of Whitman's Crossing Brooklyn Ferry. The speaker's senses fill with the panoramic view of New York Harbor, and the lines enlarge to accommodate the vision, swelling from the opening line of 11 syllables through lines of 18, 23, and eventually 28 syllables. He accomplishes a similar feat in the slow winding down at the end of Leaves of Grass, after more than 1,300 lines. The lines diminish in length over each of the two famous final verse paragraphs, lending a structural component to the gentle end of what has been called America's second Declaration of Independence. Failing to fetch me at first, keep encouraged. Missing me one place, search another. I stop somewhere, waiting for you.